man, Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking your time out of your schedule to be with us tonight. Tonight we are in our second week of our early detection and prevention series, and we have with us Dr. Jerry Tennant. We're going to be talking about his book, Healing is Voltage, and also information that he generally works with in his practice about early detection and prevention. I have to say right now, I wish I had 5 hours to interview him about this book. It's a wonderful book. So if you've never heard of it and haven't seen it, please listen and for Dr. Tennant's website and find this book, Healing is Voltage. Thank you, Dr. Tennant, for taking the time to be with us.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
It is my pleasure. And like I said, I think your book's a fabulous handbook to help people on their path to alternative healing. So before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you?
Sure. My office is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in a suburb called Colleyville. And my website is www.tennantinstitute.com. And Tennant is spelled T-E-N-N-A-N-T, TennantInstitute.com. And my office phone is 972-580-1156.
Now, I know that, and I don't want to go too far down this path because we have so much to talk about, but I know that most people who get off the trodden path usually get off it for a reason. Is there a story about, or how did you get off from practicing conventional allopathic medicine to doing something different? Was there a profound moment or experience?
Sure. I'm trained as an ophthalmologist and did this traditional ophthalmology for about 35 years, I guess. And I got to do a lot of fun things, but one of them was I did the majority of the research for the laser that's used in LASIK surgery for the company called Vizix. And I had a lot of fun doing that, but what we didn't know at the time was that the laser wouldn't kill viruses. And so as I would be treating people, the laser would open cells to remove them from the surface of the eye, and the viruses would come up in a plume and entered my mask and my nose and into my brain, and so I developed encephalitis and a bleeding disorder. So what happened to me was that I got to where I could see a patient and know what was wrong with them, but I couldn't remember how to write a prescription. And I also developed spastic movements, which doesn't work well if you're operating inside someone's eyeball. And so for those reasons, primarily I had to quit work at the end of November 1995. And so I spent about 16 hours a day sleeping with just overwhelming fatigue and mental confusion, and traveled all over trying to find someone who could help me, and they simply said, well, you have 3 viruses in your brain. We don't know what to do about it, so good luck. And so I had 2 or 3 hours a day in which I could think clearly enough to understand a newspaper, and then like a light switch, it would go off and I couldn't understand it anymore. So it became apparent to me that during those few hours that I could think, I had to figure out how to get myself well, and that's how I started down this path. So if you like, I can continue telling you how that path extended, or you can ask me another question.
You can go where there's a couple of things I wanted you to cover. Viruses, that's actually why I wanted you to talk about nitric oxide and ozone, because we seem to have an epidemic in this country of viruses right now. So you tell us what you think we need to know. You're doing a great job.
Well, thank you. Well, during that few hours a day in which I could think, I began to consider that if I could figure out how to make one cell work, I could make them all work. And so I bought a bunch of books about cellular biology and began to read them, which I hadn't done for over 30 years. And in each of those books, one of the things that tended to jump off the page at me was that cells are designed to run at a pH of 7.35 to 7.45. Well, I didn't really remember a lot about pH, except it had something to do with acid-base balance. So I began to read about that and discovered that pH is really the measurement of voltage in a solution. So it became obvious to me that they were saying that cells had to have energy to work. And of course, that made perfect sense. So as I began to read about pH, I began to understand that if you think about the electrons that are making your lights come on at the moment, there's a wire with electrons going through them and an on-off switch. And when the switch is on, the electrons are flowing, and when the switch is off, they're not. But in a solution like a glass of water or inside of a cell, you have a different situation. That in a solution, you can either have voltage as an electron donor or as an electron stealer. And so in order to measure the voltage of a solution, you take a very sophisticated voltmeter and you measure the voltage, and it will also tell you whether it's an electron donor or electron stealer.
And can I ask a question? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Do you mind if I ask a question? Would stealing or donating, would that be affiliated at all with under or over methylation?
No, that's something different, really a different subject.
Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's a different subject. No
just
problem.
Curious.
So if you measure and you get minus 400 millivolts, minus is considered to be electron donor. So minus 400 millivolts of electron donor is the same thing as a pH of 14, and plus 400 millivolts of electron stealer is considered the same as pH of 0. So the 0 to 14 pH scale is simply a logarithmic scale of the voltage of a solution. So once you realize that, you can go back to the knowledge that books tell you that cells must run at a pH of 7.35, and 7.35 is a synonym of minus 20 millivolts of electron donor, and 7.45 is minus 25 millivolts of electron donor. So basically what the books were telling me is that cells have to have between 20 and 25 millivolts of energy in order to work correctly. Now, some people get a little confused because they'll read that cells, the potential across a cell membrane is minus 90 millivolts. But that's where you take a cell and put it into a petri dish and put an electrode inside the cell and one outside the cell, and you'll measure minus 90 or so. But the environment must be minus 20 to minus 25 millivolts. Well, once I figured that out, I thought, well, gee, that's perfectly logical. Cells have to have energy to work. And because cells are 70% water, that also made a lot of sense. Well, the next thing then I began to wonder is, well, what's going on with my voltage? And I found that Japanese fellow named Nakatani was the first person to use modern electronics to measure acupuncture meridians. And he published his work in 1951. And so I bought his fairly rudimentary equipment and measured and found that my brain was running between 2 and 4 millivolts. So now I knew why it didn't work. So, of course, then the next question was, well, what can I do about it? And I ran across some Russian publications that where they had figured out the particular waveform and frequency set that would transfer energy to cell membranes. And so I bought the Russian equipment and began to treat myself. And pretty soon my brain started working again, and here I am. So that's kind of how it all began. But the the road has continued to be interesting as I've learned more and more things about how the body really works. So one of the important things that I began to understand was that we are usually taught that when you have a symptom of some sort or you feel ill, you must find some chemical that will get rid of that symptom, namely take a pharmaceutical. And if that doesn't work, you cut out the offending part and throw it away. And if that doesn't work, you're sort of out of bullets. That system, which is our Western medical system, doesn't work really well for chronic disease. And I'm a perfect example of its failure. What I began to understand was that we're constantly wearing ourselves out. So you get new cells in the macula of your eye every 48 hours. The lining of your gut's replaced every 3 days. The skin you're sitting in tonight is only 6 weeks old. Your liver's 8 weeks old, etc. So as we wear cells out, we have to make new ones. And then if we get injuries or infections or toxins of some sort that damage cells, we have to replace those as well. So I came to realize that chronic disease occurs when you lose the ability to make new cells that work. Well, I think that's important enough. I'd like to say it one more time. Chronic disease occurs when you lose the ability to make new cells that work. Well, if you buy into that paradigm, then that leads you to the question, what does it take to make a new cell that works? And what I find is that basically in all chronic disease, one of the cardinal features is inadequate voltage. Because although cells run at minus 25 millivolts, it takes minus 50 millivolts to make a new one. And by the way, new cells are generally made from stem cells that are in the neighborhood and sort of standing by, ready to be activated into a new cell of the type that we need. So voltage is the activator for that. Well, in addition to voltage, you have to have all the raw materials that you need to make a new cell. So an example of what I'm trying to explain is to consider my thumb. I have a perfectly good thumb here, works just fine, and guess what? It's running at minus 25 millivolts. Now I take a hammer and hit it. I've just smashed and destroyed some cells, and so I have to make new ones. And so my body will automatically kick up to minus 50 millivolts. And of course it does that way, it's designed that way, because that's what it's required to get to make the new cells. But when you go to minus 50 millivolts, one of the things that happens is that arterial capillaries dilate. And the reason they dilate is we need all those raw materials, and so as they dilate, they simply dump the materials we need to make cells out at the curb, so to speak. And now we're ready to get busy and make new cells to replace those we destroyed with the hammer. And then the thumb goes back to being a normal thumb. Well, while the thumb is at minus 50 millivolts and happily making new cells, with those dilated arterial capillaries, we have all the signs of and symptoms of what are standardly known as inflammation. So the thumb is red, it's swollen, it's warm, it has a pulsing pain. And by the way, when you injure it like that, it also makes you say bad words. So the process of healing always occurs with that, all of those signs and symptoms and that voltage. Now consider an alternative. I smash my thumb with a hammer and I get up to 50 millivolts and start making cells, but I run out of voltage before I finish the job and my voltage drops below 50 millivolts. Or I didn't even have the voltage to get up to 50 millivolts to start with, then I've got a totally different situation because I simply can't make new cells without adequate voltage. And that means that when your voltage is below the operating voltage, that you are stuck in chronic disease. And that is why you will almost always, when you measure it, find that the organ that is malfunctioning has a low voltage. So if you have chronic disease and you measure the voltage and it's low, you can take all the pills you want, you can do all the surgery you want, but it simply won't be successful because you can't heal until you make new cells, and you can't make new cells until you get up to minus 50 millivolts. So if we go back then and consider what happens when, as our voltage begins to drop, we begin to understand a lot of pieces of the puzzle that we've all known about but have never really put them together in an orderly fashion. So as voltage begins to drop, let's say it drops to 15 millivolts, then you're tired, and then as voltage continues to drop lower and lower, a series of bad things begin to happen. First of all, you get chronic pain. So chronic pain is simply a symptom of low voltage. And one has to realize that when you have pain, it's because the voltage is low, as if it's just a it hurts all the time kind of pain. Now, we've already discussed that up at minus 50 millivolts, you'll have a pulsing pain. But most of the pain we're talking about of chronic disease is a it hurts all the time kind of pain. Well, one of the things that also happens as voltage drops is that the amount of oxygen in the tissue drops. If I were to take a glass of water and put a tube in it and begin to bubble oxygen into the water, the amount of oxygen that would dissolve in that water is dictated by the voltage. So as I raise the voltage of the glass of water, more oxygen goes into solution. But if I lower the voltage in the water, then oxygen comes out of solution and disappears. And that's what happens in our cells, which are that are 70% water, because as our voltage lowers, then the amount of oxygen lowers. And the lower the voltage goes, the less oxygen we have available. Well, there are several bad things that happen when we don't have enough oxygen. One of them relates to the ability of us to have adequate voltage inside the cell. Inside the cell, we have a rechargeable battery system that provides energy for the various metabolic processes inside the cell. And when that battery is charged up, we call it ATP, and when it's discharged, we call it ADP. So most people have heard of intracellular energy called ATP. Well, since this is a rechargeable battery system, obviously we need a battery charger inside the cell, and we have such a thing, and it's called the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle. And its function is to take an ADP discharge battery and charge it back up to an ATP battery so that it can provide the energy the cell needs. Well, this battery charger called the Krebs cycle likes to burn fats. And for every unit of fat you run through that Krebs cycle, if oxygen's available, you get enough electrons to charge up about 36 or 38 ATP batteries. But if oxygen's unavailable, for every unit of fat you put through the battery charger, you only get enough electrons to charge up two batteries. So it's like having a car that goes from 38 miles a gallon to 2 miles a gallon. Our metabolism becomes very inefficient as oxygen drops. And you'll remember that the level of oxygen is controlled by our old friend voltage. So as voltage drops, oxygen drops. As oxygen drops, metabolism becomes very inefficient. Well, there's another bad thing that happens as oxygen begins to drop, and that has to do with infections. Now, each of us contain about a trillion bugs, and those bugs are asleep as long as oxygen is around, but as oxygen levels drop, the bugs wake up. And when the bugs wake up, the first thing they want to do is have lunch, and of course they want to have you for lunch. Well, bugs don't have teeth, so in order to get the nutrients out of our cells, they have to put out digestive enzymes. And those digestive enzymes dissolve the cells and thus give the nutrients to the bugs, to the infection. Well, consider that we have strep bugs that are having a picnic on our tonsil. And, of course, they're having a good old time, but how do we feel? Those digestive enzymes are dissolving the cells on our tonsil, and thus we have the world's worst sore throat. And those toxins get into our bloodstream and go all over the place, so we have a terrible headache. Our vision's blurry. We ache all over. We might throw up. We might have diarrhea, etc. And even worse, those toxins can go down and start dissolving and damaging our heart valves, and can go down and damage our knees, etc. And so when we have these bugs that are having their way with us, then we have all of these damages going on. And so we may have symptoms from that, or it may just be a progressive, ongoing sort of inflammation throughout the body. Now, one of the interesting things about this subject has to do with the fact that as voltage and oxygen drops, the more severe that gets, then many of the bacteria that we have in our system lose their cell membranes and become more and more pathogenic or more and more toxic. Now, that's a problem for the following reasons. In the strep example I gave you, the cell membranes on the strep bacteria cause us to have a fever, an elevated white count, a shift in the type of white cells we have, etc. So our immune system recognized that those were there, and we had all of these things going on in an effort to get rid of them. But as microorganisms lose their cell membranes, they become like the invisible stealth bombers, where radar can't see them. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Lida Madman called these stealth pathogens, cell wall deficient organisms, in her great book. Well, the problem is then, as voltage drops and oxygen drops and bugs wake up and it gets worse and worse, pretty soon the bugs that are having their way with us cannot be seen by our immune system and yet are causing more and more damage by the enzymes that they're putting out to dissolve our cells. But we don't have a fever. We don't have an elevated white count. We don't have a change in our white count. And these bugs without cell membranes cannot be cultured in standard culture media. And therefore, physicians say, well, you don't have an infection. You don't have any sign of an infection. And if we try to culture it, we don't culture out anything. And yet, they are some of the most severe bugs that we can have. And so, it's my opinion that there is no such thing as an autoimmune disease, that the body never really attacks itself. And what we think is an autoimmune disease is really this process where we have these cell wall deficient organisms that are causing problems, and their digestive enzymes are going all over the bloodstream and all over the body causing damage. But we can't culture them and can't find them, and of course antibiotics have no effect on them, except to make them grow faster. And so anytime I see somebody that has a diagnosis of an autoimmune disease, I know that they've got bugs hidden someplace. And of course, the bugs are hidden wherever the voltage is low. So if you go in and raise the voltage and thus the oxygen, the tests like the ANA test for lupus and the RF test or the RA test for rheumatoid arthritis go back to normal. Well, as voltage continues to drop, when you finally cross zero and get down to plus 30 millivolts of electron stealer, that's where cancer occurs. So basically, we've gone from minus 15 millivolts where you're tired all the way down to plus 30 millivolts for cancer, and everything in between is some other variation, but it's all associated with the voltage and our ability to make new cells. So one of the things that you've asked me to mention is ozone. There are certain therapies that are called oxidative therapies, and the three prominent oxidative therapies are ozone, hydrogen peroxide, sodium chloride, or a synonym for sodium chloride in its activated form is chlorine dioxide, and another word for hydrogen peroxide is hydrogen dioxide. These three oxidative therapies are very useful in people who have very low voltage and low oxygen because they have the ability to seek out and kill these cell wall deficient organisms that are immune to antibiotics. And so that, in my view, is the role for them. The easiest one to manage is the sodium chloride that you activate with a weak organic acid like citric acid, turn it into chlorine dioxide, and it's quite efficient at going out and killing these cell wall deficient bugs. Now, let's see. We were beginning to discuss the reason that we lose the ability to make new cells. But before I go there, let me just mention one other thing about the voltage system, and then I'll begin to speak about the other things it takes to make cells. One of the things that people would like to know, of course, is, well, how do you know what the voltage is in the cells? And, of course, we have this concept of acupuncture meridians. Now, for many years, there's been a lot of discussion and confusion and theories about what acupuncture meridians really are, and I'm going to share with you my theory about what they are and how they work. Now, first of all, you have to recognize that the fascia that we have in our body is that kind of shiny, glistening stuff that you see around a turkey leg at Thanksgiving time. It's that sheet of fibrous tissue that goes around every muscle, but also there's a sheet of it around every organ. And then from that, there are little fibers that go down to every little cluster of cells. And the interesting thing about fascia is that it's a semiconductor. So what's a semiconductor?
It's a semiconductor. Well, okay, sorry.
So a semiconductor is an arrangement of molecules that has extra electrons and allows those electrons to move very quickly from one molecule to another at the speed of light, but only in one direction. So our fascia being semiconductors means that they can move electrons from one place to another in a flash. And that explains why when you put an essential oil on your big toe, at the speed of light, its energy is already up in your brain because that fascia carries it there and also to all of your cells. Well, another interesting thing is that our muscles are piezoelectric. So what does that fancy word mean? If you take a piece of quartz and you squeeze it with a pair of pliers, it emits electrons. So this process of distorting a substance with the result of emission of electrons is called piezoelectricity. And our muscles are piezoelectric. So what that means is that every time you move a muscle, it generates electrons or voltage. Well, the other neat thing about our muscles is that they're rechargeable batteries. So every time we exercise, we are generating voltage and recharging our muscles. Well, the next piece of the puzzle is that if you recognize that the muscles are in sheath and fascia, then the fascia is like a stocking around a rechargeable a battery. And what we have then is that each organ has its own power pack. One of the fun things to think about is that the human body is actually a portable electronic device. And all portable electronic devices have to have batteries to work. And we are no different. So if you think about batteries in a flashlight, you have several batteries stacked up inside the tube. The goes up to the bulb, and that's how your flashlight works. Well, each of our organs have exactly the same system, so we have very specific muscles that are stacked together and wired together through our fascia that provide the voltage for each and every organ. And these stacks of batteries sometimes start in the toes and then go all the way up to the skull, and sometimes they start out in our fingers and go to the various organs. But nevertheless, each organ has its own battery pack. So let me give you an example of what is often confusing. When I first started reading about acupuncture, they were talking about how emotions were related to the gallbladder circuit. And I said, that does not compute. I don't understand what the gallbladder has to do with emotions. In my Western way of training, that made no sense whatsoever. But when you realize that the so-called gallbladder battery pack begins down in the little toe, comes up the outside of the leg, comes up to the gallbladder, goes up through the chest, through the to the back of the neck, and then the entire side of the head, which is the temporalis muscle, fans out like a fan around your ear. That's all one battery pack and all one circuit. So the gallbladder gets its voltage from that circuit, as does the part of the brain that stores memories and emotions. So that's how it works. So when you have low voltage in that, you have trouble with your emotions and memory, etc., as well as your gallbladder, as well as you might have pain in your little toe.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
You're probably going to cover this, but I just want to make sure. Because it's been on my mind lately about this. When you want to stimulate those acupuncture points with oils, and I know you have some oils, but I just want to get this. Do you use oils that are cooling and oils that are warming, or does it matter what kind of oil you put on there? I mean, I know it's got to be essential oils, but how do you decide which kind of oil to put on an acupuncture point to make something happen?
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that the oils don't change the voltage. It's a totally different subject and a different function in the cell. When we have a stem cell that is totipotent, that it means it is capable of becoming anything. It has all of the all of the genes necessary for any cell to function. But when it gets made into a cell, then it gets rid of the frequencies that it doesn't need. But what happens is that every organ in the body runs at a different frequency, just like a different radio stations. And the frequencies that are coming out of the DNA of those cells are telling the proteins in the cell what they're supposed to be doing. And so that is basically sort of like cellular software, if you want to think of it in computer terms. So if in a computer you hit the letter A, you expect to see the letter A up on the screen. But it can happen that that can get system of I's and O's can get confused, and you hit an A and you get an N up on the screen or some other number. So it can happen that the frequencies coming out of the DNA to tell the proteins in the cell what to do get confused. Well, fortunately for us, plants run at the same frequencies as human organs. And so if you are able to identify the and correspond the plant to the organ you're interested in, then the oils from that plant can go in and reset the frequencies in very much the way that Norton or McAfee might on your computer. So okay. The function of essential oils is to reset your cellular software, whereas we have to do other things when we have low voltage.
So how did you figure out which kind of oil? Did you research it on the internet, or did you get some intuitive thing to figure out which oil would you use on that gallbladder to deal with emotions, say?
Well, there is a lot of information out there about what oils do what and how they work. I spent several years actually going through and creating a informational database of what the oils do. Oils are actually a whole other subject. We could spend an hour talking about them, but for example, most of the active ingredients in oils are terpenes, although there are also phenols and alcohols and so forth. But for example, one of the things that you want oils to do is to go in and remove things that are blocking receptor sites, as well as resetting the frequencies. And one set of oils will do that, and then another set of oils will come in and reprogram the system. And so what you need to do if you're going to figure out how what oils to use and how to make them work, then you have to assimilate all of this information. And that's what I did, and I wanted to keep it simple so people didn't have to think about that. So the oils that I put together and blended have one set of oils for each different organ system in the body, and all you have to do is put three of them on the feet and three of them on the hands, and you've done everything, so you don't have to think.
Okay. Sorry, I've been thinking about that lately and wanted to understand that.
Did I explain it well enough? Are you okay with it?
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Okay, so now these stacks of muscle batteries have, like batteries are prone to do, have poles. So if you wanted to check a battery and see if it's charged up, you take a voltmeter and you put it on each end of a battery, and it'll tell you what its charge is. Well, you can't use a standard voltmeter in the body because the body voltage pulses. You have to measure it with other things. But the point is that we have these same type of poles. So it takes me about 20 minutes or so to teach people where these poles are, and then you can come with something like my biomodulator, put it in the voltmeter mode or the assess mode, and put it on that particular point, and that will tell you what the voltage is in each corresponding organ. So we have then with the biomodulator the ability to very quickly know what the total body voltage is and what the voltage is in every organ, and that tells us which organs are fine and which ones are going to have trouble running and repairing themselves. Now, a few other things we should try to get in the 20 minutes or so we've got left here, and that has to do with the raw materials that it takes to make cells. So not only do you have to have the voltage to do it, you have to have all of the things it takes to make a cell. Well, the inside of most cells is made from amino acids. So what's the body's source for amino acids? Well, it's actually the stomach and stomach acid. What most people ignore is the fact that the human body is designed to never, never, ever absorb proteins. You must only absorb amino acids. So the way we're designed is that when you eat a protein, stomach acid breaks those proteins into amino acids, you absorb those, and then make your own proteins. And the reason that's so important is that it's the only way your immune system can function normally. So there's a gland that's just behind our breastbone called the thymus gland. The thymus gland contains a database of all the proteins that are you. And when you make white blood cells, they go through the thymus gland and the database is downloaded into the white cell. So if you eat a protein and don't have stomach acid, and that protein goes downstream and gets absorbed, then when the white cells are coming around the boulevard, they bump into a protein and they check and see if it's in the database, and they say, oh, you're me, have a nice day, and it goes on to the next one and finds that one that your body doesn't make, and it'll say, oh, you're not in my database, you're a bacteria or something else here to hurt me, and it calls in the immune troops, which builds antibodies and tries to destroy that protein. And if it can't destroy it, it stuffs it into fat cells to try to protect your body from it. What that means is when you eat a protein and you don't have enough stomach acid, and you let whole proteins go downstream, you will become allergic to every single thing you eat. So 20 minutes, 40 minutes after a meal, you'll have this mini case of the flu going on because your body is attacking all the food you just ate. Now, the people have a tendency to think that, well, I ate a carbohydrate, I don't have to worry about that. But that's not the case, because every carbohydrate has its own identifying protein attached with it. So people have become quite aware of the protein that's attached to grains, which is called gluten or gliadin. So when you eat grains, like you eat a slice of bread, and you don't have stomach acid, then that gluten goes down, is absorbed. Your white cells look at it and say, hey, I didn't make that gluten. It must be something here to hurt me. And so you develop antibodies against gluten, and now you're gluten sensitive. So gluten is not the problem. The problem is not having stomach acid to break the gluten down into amino acids. Because, just as I said, you shouldn't absorb any protein. You must only absorb the amino acids that they're made from. So a person can just as easily become allergic to a raspberry or a strawberry or a blueberry or anything else that's a carb, because you will become allergic to its identifiable protein. Now, what that means is that if you don't have stomach acid, then you don't have the amino acids that you need to build the inside of cells. And by the way, all of the nervous system, all of the nerve cells, instead of being almost totally amino acids, the inside of them is 50% cholesterol. So anyone who takes drugs to shut down their ability of their liver to make cholesterol is guaranteed to eventually have a malfunctioning brain and nervous system, because you can't keep it repaired if you don't have adequate amounts of cholesterol. The outside of cells are made of fat. To absorb fat requires bile. So the liver makes a quart and a half of bile a day, and thus it needs a storage tank, and that's the function of the gallbladder. So when your digestive sludge hits the small intestine, there's a hormone that is made by the pancreas called cholecystokinin, which tells the liver to make more bile and the gallbladder to squirt some into the digestive tract, and then you're able to absorb your fats. Well, the signal that tells your pancreas to make cholecystokinin is stomach acid. So if you don't have any stomach acid, then you never get the signal to make cholecystokinin. So the liver gets stopped up with the sludge of unused bile. The gallbladder doesn't ever empty, so it ends up developing stones, and you become deficient in all your fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, and you don't have the fats that are necessary to make good cell membranes. So again, both have the ability to make the inside of cells and the outside of cells is controlled by stomach acid. Well, to make stomach acid requires five things: vitamin B1, iodine, zinc, salt, and the voltage to make it. So approximately 90% of the American population is deficient in iodine, about 80% are deficient in zinc, and many are on salt-restricted diets, and many have decay in their upper molars, which we didn't talk about, but it's in the same circuit, acupuncture circuit, as your stomach. So if you have an infected upper molar, you won't have enough voltage to make stomach acid either, and you're going to become allergic to all of your foods and have trouble making cells.
I missed one of those things. What did you say were the five things?
Vitamin B1, iodine, zinc, salt, and the voltage to use them.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Well, cells also require vitamins and minerals, and the ability of those to enter the cell is controlled by a substance called fulvic, F-U-L-V-I-C, fulvic. And because of our farming practices, most of our food supply is deficient in fulvic. And when you take vitamins and minerals that come from petroleum or just from dirt, you can't use those, and they just pass on through. It's Well, in addition, you have to have oxygen, and oxygen is under the control, or the availability of oxygen is under control of nitric oxide. And we'll come back in a minute and talk a little more about nitric oxide, but you have to have adequate amounts of that, and most people are deficient after the age of 40. And then, of course, you have to have water. And the water inside of a cell isn't H2O, it's H3O2, which is an electron donor form of water, which has been called the fourth phase of water. And then, of course, you have to deal with any toxins that are hanging around that are causing grief. And one of the major problems that we have is that many people are poisoned with mercury, primarily from their fillings and from eating seafood. And mercury goes in and damages the enzyme systems that are necessary for people to methylate. And this whole subject of methylation is also a little more extensive, but let me just quickly go through it in the short amount of time we have left.
We got to finish up probably about 3 minutes before the hour, just so you know.
Okay. So one of the things that happens when metabolism is going on and our cells are doing the job of doing whatever they're supposed to do often involves the exchange of what's called a methyl group. And a methyl group is a carbon with three hydrogens hooked to it. So the truck that tends to carry methyl groups around is called SAM, which stands for S-adenosyl methionine. Much easier to say SAM. So SAM's going along and it finds somebody who needs a methyl group. So SAM hands it off and says, here's a methyl group. And SAM immediately converts into a molecule called homocysteine. Well, if all of the SAM trucks unload all their methyl groups and convert into homocysteine, pretty soon two bad things would happen. One is you'd run out of SAMs, and the second thing is you'd have way too much homocysteine, and homocysteine is actually toxic and damaging, particularly to the heart. So we have to have a system to convert homocysteine back to being SAM again, which means we have to have something that's capable of handing or loading another methyl group back onto homocysteine so it'll turn back into SAM. And there are more than one of those systems, but that process of what we're talking about here is called methylation. And the enzyme systems that are necessary to make all of this work often become damaged in a significant way by things like mercury. So, for example, one of the things that has the ability to put methyl groups back on homocysteine is vitamin B12. And B12 is called cobalamin, and its normally occurring form is called cyanocobalamin, which means copper B12. But you can't use that because you have to convert it to methyl cobalamin or methyl B12. And the process of turning the copper form into the methyl form has an enzyme system, and if that enzyme system doesn't work, then you can't use the copper because the body can only use the methyl form. And so the same thing happens with folate, the same thing happens with vitamin B6, etc. And so oftentimes our enzyme systems get damaged because we have toxins, and thus we can't methylate. And thus we end up with too much homocysteine, not enough SAM, and the whole system begins to malfunction. Did I explain that well enough to you?
Just done beautifully on all of these topics. Thank you. I'm getting things that I've never quite clicked before. If you could save me a minute or two to ask questions at the end, that would be great.
All right. So the let's see, you had asked me to speak about, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about nitric oxide. Nitric oxide has multiple functions in the body, but one of its more important ones is that it's responsible for dilating our blood vessels, particularly at the capillary level or the small vessel level. So there are multiple places in the body where nitric oxide can be made, but the most active one during most of our life is actually the lining cells inside our arteries. The endothelial cells can make nitric oxide and thus keep themselves dilated. But over time, that system begins to fail us, so most people past the age of 40 begin to have insufficient nitric oxide. And thus, the vessels get smaller and smaller and smaller, and thus, it gets harder and harder for us to get blood and therefore oxygen and other nutrients to all of our tissue. So almost anybody, even little kids, will tell you the older people get, the worse their circulation gets. Right, that's kind of a given. And that's why, of course, people who are in their older years often go around wearing sweaters and coats when everybody else is in shorts and cutoffs, is because their circulation's poor. So why is their circulation poor? Because they don't have nitric oxide. So critical of restoring things to function is having enough nitric oxide. Now, if we review what we've been talking about, we said that the amount of oxygen that will dissolve in a cell is dictated by the voltage of a cell. So one of the things that controls oxygen is voltage. But the other is you have to have some oxygen in the neighborhood. If there's no oxygen around, you could have really high voltage in the cell, but that wouldn't help if there's no oxygen to dissolve in the cell. So the oxygen has to be brought into the neighborhood by our circulation, namely, our vascular system has to be dilated enough that the red blood cells can get there. So poor circulation and thus poor oxygenation is a combination of not enough nitric oxide to open up the vessels to get the oxygen into the neighborhood and low voltage in order to so that you can't dissolve it in yourself. Which, by the way, what I just told you explains why hyperbaric oxygen works, because hyperbaric oxygen doesn't put oxygen onto the red blood cells. It puts it into the liquid part of our blood, namely the plasma, and oftentimes the liquid can get places that the red blood cells can't. But nevertheless, nitric oxide is essential then. And not only does nitric oxide have a great role in correcting problems with our circulation and thus our oxygen levels, but it also has a role in the way, the regularity with which our heart beats. So, for example, many people who have atrial fibrillation, once you correct their nitric oxide, their heart often goes back to normal rhythm. And the easiest way to correct nitric oxide is with a lozenge that's made by a company called Neogenesis, and it's called Neo-40. Now, there are many people out there who think, well, I'll fix the nitric oxide by taking arginine, but studies have shown that in people past 40, often, if you take just arginine, it goes into the wrong circuit and will make nitric acid instead of nitric oxide, which is damaging. And so it's not really the best idea to take arginine. You should take something that's better designed, like the Neo-40.
Well, I think we're going to have to end right there. I hope you'll come back. You've been fabulous.
Thank you very much.
And your book is fabulous. And the book, again, is Healing is Voltage by Dr. Jerry Tennant. Thank you so much, Dr. Tennant. I appreciate what you've done.
Well, thanks for having me on. Be well.
Thank you. Good night.